Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be talking again with Dr. Joe Stavas, clinical professor of radiology at the UNC School of Medicine, but this time about unexpected duty, a doctor's call to action.
Yeah, it was amazing, Christy. His story and his daughter's story about the Boston bombing and being there and jumping into action is profound. And I think it's a lesson for all of us about when you get called to duty, how you respond.
Just absolutely remarkable. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about doctors and how many tests they order if they know the prices.
About when you get prescriptions in the emergency room, does the prescriptions get filled at all?
About if we're addicted to added sugar in America.
And about the hospital prices, do you really know what you're getting charged?
Let's first talk about doctors ordering tests. This is pretty amazing. It was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine recently, looking to see if doctors who knew the prices of the lab tests they were ordering for their hospitalized patients, if that changed their practice in any way.
And this is, in some ways, not surprising that when the doctors were given the price of the laboratory tests, they actually appeared to order less tests. And in this one institution, it might have been $400,000 worth of less tests over the period of time that they were studied. They went from 3.7 tests per day down to an average of these physicians ordering 3.4 lab tests per day for hospitalized patients.
And you might think at face value, ordering less tests might not be good. But the motive here is to order the tests that are helpful to guide the care of the patient without just sort of ordering a whole bunch of expensive tests without discrimination. So having the price tag really, it seems like we can imply or infer that the doctors had to think about it. Okay, well, do I need that test or not?
Well, an example is we order chemistry profiles. This gives us 18 different lab tests sometimes. The good news is you could order that really quickly by one checky box on the order sets. The problem is when you have to think about each one of those tests, you will maybe order less tests. It might be less expensive, but it will take more time. And I think this is one of the trade-offs here. It's a good trade-off. I think doctors should be thinking about it, but you also have to be efficient in your time.
Well, there'll be much more on that as we try to figure out ways to take care of people well in a way that doesn't cost so much.
And we hopefully the incentive isn't to order less tests too, because that could be a problem. If the incentive that the hospital would make more money by ordering less tests, then that's a problem on the other end. We wanted the right test for the right condition for the right patient.
That's right. Well, let's talk about helping the right patients take the right medicines. And this is a study looking at the number of patients who go to the emergency room and are discharged and any strategies that might influence their actually taking the medicine they're prescribed.
And it makes sense that a large number of people get prescribed medicines in the emergency room that they don't end up taking. That intervention to help that and improve that would work. And this was research that was in the Annals of Emergency Medicine with over 4,000 patients in the emergency room on discharge got put into one of four different conditions.
And you either went through normal hospital procedures or another group received practical help filling the prescription if they asked for it. Another group got information that was printed about their prescription. And a fourth group got help filling the prescription and a printed information about the medications.
And a week after the discharge from the emergency room, less than 90% or 88% of the patients had filled the prescription, which you might say, oh, that's pretty good. But only 48%, less than really half of all the patients who got a prescription reported taking it as prescribed. And it didn't make any difference which group you were in. So they concluded that this strategy alone did not actually make a difference.
Well, and I would want to know more about which of those medicines really were optional. If they were inflammatory medicines, maybe help with pain, to say, well, you could take this prescription that might help, versus medications like an antibiotic or something that where the physician really thought this is going to help your condition. So I think teasing it out a little bit more, it makes sense that not everybody needs all those prescription medicines.
It doesn't. But if you're a listener out there and you have a loved one, or you've gone to the emergency room and you get a prescription written, mm-hmm. sit down and ask the doctor, do I really need to take this? Do I take it only if I'm not better? Do I take it till it's gone? Maybe it's incumbent upon that in getting our patients really engaged and
Absolutely.
Involved here.
What
I'm
is
not
this
so
for?
Sure that they got patients really engaged and involved in this research.
I completely agree with you. The third study is about the amount of added sugar that Americans consume in our diet.
And the question is, are we following the guidelines that the Centers for Disease Control and other dietary authorities put out for limiting our total intake of added sugars in our diet, added fats, and calories that are kind of what empty calories? They don't really help us grow. If we're limiting those to 5 to 15% of the total calories that we take in every day.
So this looked at those total calories and found that Americans between the time of 2005 to 2010 got 13% of total calories from added sugar alone. So it was supposed to be 15% at the top end for sugars, fats, and other extra calories, and we are at 13% just from added sugar alone.
And the great majority of those added sugars are the sweetened sodas.
Sure,
that
drinks.
People drink. And then some of the other added sugars are the foods that one might eat, like peanut butter, that if you buy some of them that have added sugar in it versus 100% natural, you're getting that added sugar, and that goes up to too high percentages.
And although the sugar-sweetened soda was the single biggest source, they did find that overall 67% of the added sugars were from food that were eaten at home, along with 58% of added sugars from drinks. So people are making some of these choices not just by eating out at fast food restaurants and out in the community, but they're buying it and bringing it home. So something that we need to look at in our own households.
Speaking of look at, we need to all take a look at this next and last research that matters about the prices that you get charged when you go into the hospital for procedures.
This is shocking. So there is this new Medicare.
No, I'm sorry. You're right, Christy. It's shocking, but it's not just the cost. That alone.
It's the charge.
Yes.
So new Medicare data show the charges among the nation's hospitals for like the most common inpatient treatments and procedures. And there are huge differences just in what a hospital charges. So let's give a couple of examples.
So if you went in for a hip and knee replacement in Los Angeles in 2011, you might pay as much as $223,000. The hospital might charge $223,000. And if you were in Southland, which is maybe one of our listeners will look up where Southland is, but that would be $32,000, or seven times lower for the same procedure.
Also, the average hospital charge for a diagnosis and treatment of pneumonia in the hospital ranged from $17,000 to nearly $70,000 just in the LA area alone. So there's huge variation just in what the hospital charges for the same procedure or treatment.
And so the implications are that Medicare is going to start requiring that hospitals actually put down what their charges are for these procedures. But the problem is, it's not just the charges that we care about and that you as our patients and listeners care about. It's what you actually have to pay. But the problem is that what you have to pay out of pocket sometimes is linked to these charges.
Right. It might be 20% copay. Well, 20% of $70,000 is very different than 20% of $17,000.
I think the bottom take home is that when you are going in for a procedure, you're contemplating one, look around a little bit, see what the charges are before you go in, make sure that it's reasonable, and find out exactly what you're going to have to pay. And if the charges are 3, 4, 5 times higher, at least start that conversation before you get the bill.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Joe Stavas about unexpected duty, a doctor's call to action. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we are really privileged to have back with us Dr. Joe Stavas, clinical professor of radiology at the UNC School of Medicine, to talk about unexpected duty, a doctor's call to action. Welcome back to Your Health, Dr. Stavas.
Well, thank you very much, Adam and Christy. It's nice to be back.
Well, we weren't anticipating having you back quite so soon, and unfortunately, you've had quite a turn of events during the time that since we've talked to you last. Help us set the stage for what happened for you as you were running the Boston Marathon.
I was running with my daughter, Natalie, who's up in Boston, actually doing a pediatric residency, and we've run it 3 times before, and she called me last fall and said, "Dad, what do you think about running it again?" And after quite a long pause and a few, "Well, I don't know," understanding the training that it takes, I finally did cave in to one of my kids and said, "Sure, it's going to be a great father-daughter bonding experience." Mm. So that's kind of how it began.
And the bonding was fine up until about mile 26.
yes, we bonded well. I actually got a little bit stiffer as the race went on. She somehow had this surge of energy.
That's called youth.
And youth. I don't know. Maybe she took a few more anti-inflammatories than what I did. And she was feeling pretty good. She's a great runner and very athletic. And I had run it before. I actually ran it in the heat of last year and thought, well, she'd like to run it with me again this year when the temperatures were much milder, a little bit of a breeze to our back, and it was just actually a gorgeous day, a perfect day for a marathon.
Flash forward, what happened?
Boy, Adam and Christy, it took us all by surprise. We were nearing the finish line. There's a T-shirt that you commonly see on sale in Boston at marathon time. It says right on Hereford and left on Boylston. Well, those are the last 2 turns you make before you head down the final straightaway on Boylston. I can distinctly remember, and even to this day, if I think about it, maybe a little PTSD, I can remember a noise in my left ear, and I still hear it, of a loud, loud booming noise. I thought it was a thunderclap or a truck that was barreling down the street somehow, which was unusual because all the streets were blocked off. So it was different. You know, you run races and you kind of get into this flow and this zone and you hear the roar of the crowd and just the applause. And plus, you're nearing the finish line. There's always the best sign you like to see running a marathon is 1 mile to go. And when you hit that, you kind of develop a little bit of an adrenaline surge and you start moving along. But that noise kind of made us wonder. And then suddenly the race stopped. Policemen, race officials came and just stopped the crowd of runners shortly before we were on our last straightaway.
And so what was your understanding? I imagine you were very confused, but what did they say to you about why they were barricading and stopping the crowd?
Initially, Christy, no one knew. We had asked the officials ahead of us, and they said there's been a temporary stoppage of the marathon, which is very strange. I've run in many marathon road races, and for someone to come by and say, "All right, stop the show," with thousands of runners behind you, was very, very unusual. People on the sidelines were grabbing their cell phones, wondering what was going on, too. And a lot of runners do carry cell phones. My daughter had one, and she tried to call my wife, who was at the finish line or near the finish line, and none of the cell phones worked. Someone on the side, one of the spectators, yelled out, "There's been an explosion at the finish line." And that's about all we heard. And now things started to kind of click and ambulances started to peel off down the street. And first there were dozens of police cars, dozens of ambulances, then policemen on motorcycles, and then policemen on bicycles, then policemen running. We thought, this isn't just a little accident. This could be something a little more serious.
So the unexpected call to duty, you're a doctor, your daughter's a doctor, but you're running a race. You're off duty. but your first instinct, your daughter's first instinct, was to do something. Tell us about that instinct, and how did you just focus on to moving into the doctor role?
My daughter said, "Dad, we've got to be there. Let's get there. I can get us there." Even though we were bottlenecked and stopped, she knew Boston, knew the side alleys, knew how to get there. So in her mind, she did not see it as an obstacle of trying to work our way around this barricade. And we both said, yeah, we've got something to offer. We know something about healthcare. She's in pediatrics, has worked as an intensive care nurse. And so she had that. I'm in an area, too, that sees a lot of critical patients. And so we kind of had that again, adrenaline rush. Now, mind you, after 26 miles, mine was very, very minimal. I don't think my adrenal glands had much more to to give, but I could see her eyes said, "We've got to be there," in the tone of her voice. And I said, "Let's go." So we jumped off the course. She meandered her way back. She was able to make it down to the second bomb site. And I was kind of elbowed back with the crowd that was now rushing away from the bombs down Boylston Street. So I kind of went back to where the group of runners were. And then, again, the hypothermia and the dehydration and things like that were affecting the runners came to light, because the first thing when I got back, I heard the old familiar, "Is there a doctor around?" And I know that many of us in healthcare, whatever aspect of healthcare, you frequently hear that cry. And that, again, said, okay, I can't make it that way, but now there's a number of people that really do need a healthcare provider of some sort.
And so you yourself, for going through your own bodily suffering from having gone that far, couldn't stay with your daughter ahead, but there was a need right there in front of you. And so you had to shift from sticking together with your family to caring for the people in front of you and putting aside your own bodily needs. What was that like for you?
It was fearful. I was afraid because I knew that my wife was at the near the finish line, and it turns out she was right across from the second bomb. And we have some photographs that my daughter took when she was assisting some of the victims. And last weekend, I went back to Boston to kind of symbolically finish the race. And she showed me where she was standing. And it was as if when my wife was being told and yelled at by the police and fire to get away, scatter, she was going one way. I can just envision my daughter, without her knowing it, going right back into this second bomb site. At that point, runners were concerned. I think we were worried about the people that were at the finish line and if they could have been injured as well. But there was no way to get to them. And I felt that this is like many families feel when they send a son or a daughter off to a war, or the visions or images of casualties that happen, and you're just waiting and not sure what to expect when you do somehow expect the worst.
So help us kind of leapfrog. At what point in time do you say, I'm going to move back away from my role as a doctor?
It took a while. I was in this helping mode, in this service mode. And when I visited with my daughter about it, she was completely zoned out about any kind of well-being for herself and was totally focused on going to the victims and going to the bomb sites. I don't remember even thinking about that at that point. I felt that there were immediate needs. I recall about a 70 or so year old lady that was on the ground, white as could be, shivering, couldn't remember her name. In her situation, we were able to gather some blankets and coats that people had. We began knocking on doors of some of the large brownstones along Commonwealth Avenue to see if we could get in. In her situation, a police man did come up, and we said, can we go down the street? There was a restaurant down there, and we actually shuffled her into the restaurant just so she could get some fluids and warm up.
Well, we do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will continue talking with our heroic guest, Dr. Joe Stavas, about unexpected duty, a doctor's call to action. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Joe Stavas from UNC about unexpected duty, doctor's call to action, and his experience with his daughter in the Boston Marathon, serving the people unexpectedly as a runner himself. And I wonder, Dr. Stavas, we touched a little bit on some of these difficult decisions of taking care of yourself and your family while also needing to, at that moment, care for the people around you. And I know this isn't the first time you've had this kind of experience as a physician. Tell us a little bit about that moment, maybe from this example or a previous one, where you're having to make those choices.
It's always easy, or it's easier just to sort of melt back in the crowd and kind of be just another face, because it does take a certain amount of I don't want to say courage, because those are all sort of hard terms to identify and to really describe, but it does take maybe a certain amount of either confidence or just something internally in your upbringing or your training or your commitment to health, to know that you can help and you can assist in the situation, even though it's something minimal. I think that many people do understand a lot of basic methods of resuscitation. I think this brings up the good subject of the public health of coming to the aid of somebody. Are we doing a good enough job in our schools educating children of all ages, even adults, on CPR and diabetes and these issues that do face a lot of people that we know we can do something about. But I do think that it is either a commitment or just an understanding of not, being afraid to, I guess, maybe if I could use the term, be a good Samaritan.
Well, so an example, which I know you've had experience with, on an airplane, the announcement comes over, is there a doctor on board? They're not looking to reward you for your past acts of heroism. There's someone that's ill on board. Tell us about the experience that you've had with that.
On a flight just a couple of years ago from the Midwest back to RDU, shortly after takeoff, there was an announcement over the speaker, is there a doctor on board, because we need somebody to take care of a small child in row 14. And I'm looking at my seat, and I'm in row 15.
You're pretty close.
I'm pretty close. I couldn't really shirk this responsibility. So I kind of peek up over the chair, and there was a child having what looked like some kind of convulsion or some kind of shaking episode. It was a couple that was flying from overseas. I did raise my hand and I said, I'm a physician and I'll go a row up and try to help out. I really didn't know what I was getting myself into, because it turns out that this family did have a large set of medical records that they were carrying with this child. The child had a very, very complex history that went along with it, but I wasn't sure, really what to do in the case of a four-year-old child that was from India. And it turns out that I was just kind of going through some basic things, and her breathing was okay. She looked very dehydrated. I thought it may have been due to just long travel times that this family had, and he was coming here to work, and they had been in the plane quite a while, and maybe, was a little bit low on sugar, high on sugar. I asked the attendant there if anybody on board had a glucometer, something basic to check the sugar, and she let out another announcement, and six people came forward and said, yes, I've got one in my purse. We'll bring it up. So it turns out the sugar was a little bit low. We found some candy and peanuts and kind of fixed her up and gave her some fluids. And it did turn out to be a happy story, because I think she was probably dehydrated and just exhausted The parents also were exhausted from long, long hours of flight. But the funny thing was the captain calling me up to the front cabin there and talking on the phone between the door. And he said, "Doc, what do you think? Should I take her down?" And he was asking if I should call for an emergency landing. Like right then and there. And I thought, well, I don't know. I think we're okay there, Captain. Let's just keep on flying.
Well, I think that brings up a few points. One, in that I think as doctors, sometimes we think, well, we can't really do anything. Either I'm not the right kind of doctor, I don't have enough training for children or for whatever the situation, or we don't have any equipment. We don't have stuff with us, doctor stuff. But yet, sometimes those simple things and other people who step forward really make a difference. But I wonder with decisions about landing a plane and how to be creative about figuring out someone's blood sugar, for example, how well do you think your training prepared you for that? And what should we do to prepare nurses and doctors in those situations?
Part of it is that we all do have basic medical training, and we do understand the respiratory system and an open airway and just the basics of cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And then if you just carry it a step further about the common ailments that we have in our society, which are going to be diabetes and high blood pressure and poor eating habits, I think with that core of knowledge, it's pretty easy to figure out. And I know what you're saying, Christy, about the sub-specialization of so many physicians and healthcare workers, that they go, "Oh, not me. I only take care of this."
Or all arrive and everybody finds out their specialty then people back up.
I only do the pinky finger.
That's right. Yeah. And we were actually working with a Boy Scout group one time, and one of the dads was an OBGYN. And he thought, well, I'll just go on, with some of the camping trips and not need to do anything. Well, lo and behold, we ran across a group of Girl Scouts, which the Boy Scouts actually, thought was pretty cool. But there were a couple of moms then that were having some gynecologic problems that were out in the middle of nowhere. And so even his advice in that little area did come in handy. But I do think that we as physicians and healthcare workers, no matter what area, if it's physical therapy, OT, nursing, pharmacy, we all do have this fund of knowledge that can at least alert some kind of EMS to get into action. And I think that's what we saw in Boston. So many of the people did the basics. They checked, are you breathing? Is there something we need to do with an airway? Is there a circulation problem? Is there blood that needs to be stopped or heart that needs to be pumped? And then you alert the EMS, which then takes it from there. And I believe that that is what put that whole system together and created such a successful transfer of and triage of patients to the hospitals in Boston to take care of those people.
Well, I know that Christy and I were grateful for you and your daughter and all of the healthcare providers of all sorts and lay people who were heroic and helped save lives. And I wonder, as you reflect on there will be new incidents, future things, the unpredicted, how does reflecting back on this experience change you moving forward?
To me, it's obvious that people do need to step forward. I think even average Joe citizen needs to step forward in many cases. They have seen enough, if it's not on a TV show or reality show, that they can provide CPR. I think we need to have more public awareness of this. As I mentioned, schools and other institutions, organizations need to get on board with some of these measures. And I do think that it will make a difference.
Well, it sounds like both you and your daughter have inspired a lot of people from what you did in Boston. And that decision to run towards the action instead of away, so profound and heroic, that it's those kinds of stories and experiences that will inspire others to do the same. So we thank you for what you did for so many people and for taking this extra time with us to share your experience.
Well, thank you very much, Christy and Adam. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And we know that you did a blog for Your Health where you have pictures about actually going back to Boston and crossing the finish line. Very powerful, and we encourage our listeners to read your blog, and hopefully it'll inspire others, and I'm sure it will.
Okay, well, thank you. I hope you do, and there's a lot of pictures out there and a lot of phenomenal stories, and more will be coming out.
Coming up on House Calls, We'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
You can send your own comments and we'll listen to them on the show. Send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask one of our producers, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question that we have today.
I've heard if someone stops smoking, their lungs can return back to normal. Is this true? If so, how long does it take for this process?
Well, the answer, unfortunately, is it depends. If your question implies that you're thinking of stopping smoking, if you are a smoker and you're thinking of stopping, yes, that is the best thing you could do for your health. So good decision. Whether or not your lungs totally return back to normal depends on the amount of lung damage that's already there. So if you have what's called emphysema or COPD, or long-term lung damage from smoking from a long time, it can slow the progression of that, and it's a good decision to quit, but it doesn't reverse the damage that you've already done.
It's kind of like that tipping point. You know, if you've gone past the tipping point, you're on the downward slope. You can't go back over that hill. But for a lot of people, particularly younger people, when you're no longer smoking or exposed to secondhand smoke, there's a pretty dramatic improvement in lung function, Christy. You know, those studies that they do for bartenders and waitresses that when they eliminate the smoking in the bars, the lung function of those who are exposed gets better within a month, and it's just dramatic improvements. And for most people, their lungs can return significantly. So the good news here is let's go on and help you quit. Help your loved ones quit, and your lungs in most cases will definitely get better.
Let's take our very next House Call question.
I'm a 57-year-old woman who experienced menopause 5 years ago. 2 months ago, I began my period again. I saw my GYN and was sent through a battery of tests. Luckily, everything is normal, and I was told that it was due to stress and that my hormone levels were off. Like clockwork, I continue to get my period once a month. Are there any medications I can take to make my hormone levels return to normal?
Well, this is an interesting and a complex question, which gets into at what age do people actually normally go through menopause, which is about the age here of our House Call questioner.
People often go through menopause in that 45 to 55-year-old time frame, and menopause is defined by not having a period for a year. So in your case, it sounds like you went through menopause and then started having your period again. And having an endometrial biopsy, or a procedure where it can be done in the office where we just take a little sample inside, is very, very important to make sure this isn't a sign of cancer. It sounds like that was already done.
And in a number of people, I don't have as much experience, Christy, when we get to, you know, the late 50s, younger women, we would frequently put them on a birth control pill after we had ruled out the potentialities here. And there may be some treatments for several months to probably help regulate here. But you would do this really with your family doctor, with your gynecologist here, particularly making sure that there really isn't any cancer before you ever get started.
Absolutely. And, you know, the oral contraceptive pills are very helpful in your younger years to help sort of tolerate weird periods. But at 57, there is a higher risk of having a stroke or blood clots or other problems to be on that those medications. There are procedures like IUD that we've talked about many times. It has a little bit of progesterone, or certain procedures that can kind of clean out or ablate is a fancy word to the
Cut
lining of your uterus. Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to say it nicely. To the lining of your uterus, or other surgical procedures that could potentially help if it came to that. But we certainly wish you all the best.
I deal with that stress too. We wanted to help you deal with that stress, because that's what you said was causing it.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our next House Call question.
Are there any real health benefits to detoxing or fasting diets to cleanse the body of toxins?
Any health benefits? No.
Probably not.
That'll get us in trouble, though. So should we hedge here? There's no real data here that this detoxification or colonic irrigations that I know some people will swear by, but there really is no evidence that these do improve health.
I completely agree. I do think, though, that if it helps you to have a couple of days where you're focusing on your health, the diet itself may not be helping, but the decision for wellness might. So that's something to consider.
And I know that in many religious traditions, fasting is part of a religious tradition where you go through periods of time. And we're really not talking about that because that really maybe has benefits for you in that particular circumstance. But particularly if you have to pay a lot of money to get detoxification, the more money it is, the less I would like it.
Good point. Okay, let's take our very last house call question.
Now that my doctor started giving me printouts of my visit with her, I saw that she listed as the diagnosis for me that I have somatoform disease. While I do not have a lot of problems every time I go to see her, it's not in my head. I am a little confused and a little angry.
So many issues that this brings up. The most important one, I would say, is communication with your doctor. That seeing that printout of diagnoses that may have been attached to your chart over the years can be shocking. And if there's something you have a question about, and before getting too upset about it, would be to talk with your doctor.
And just like if you have depression, that's nothing to be embarrassed or ashamed about. That's very frequent, or anxiety. Somatoform disorder means that you're really in tune with your body. That's a good thing, and you're real sensitive to the way you act and feel. So we don't feel too bad, but talk with your doctor more and tell him that you are a little confused and angry, because I think sharing that information with him will bring actually the two of you closer together.
Yes, and that might give a chance to understand how the doctor at one point thought your physical symptoms were related to your mental health and overall the body-mind relationship in a way that helps you understand your health.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, Christy. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you and your health. And you can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
And we want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Joe Stavas. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.